Ashwapati has arrived at the overmental levels of existence, and he has embodied the consciousness of the One, which includes the many. He has also identified himself with the cosmic will, attuned himself to the supernal harmonies, and has arrived at the gates of the supramental world. That's where the second book ended. The mystery, the ultimate reality, still eludes him. He has understood, in a way, all that has been created. He has traversed the many worlds and planes. But what's the origin? What's the source? That mystery is still to be scaled, still to be realized. And we begin the third book with the pursuit of the unknowable. So the mystery is unknowable. Unknowable indeed by the mind. But as Sri Aurobindo explains, it is realizable in the being, in consciousness. And let us see how Ashwapati comes to know or realize what is so far the unknown. First, he makes a few general observations of the state of things in our world. All is too little that the world can give. The world gives us every moment something. But the best, the most that the world can give us is one day realized to be very insignificant. One wonders whether what we prided upon, what we were so fond of having, has been worth all the trouble. Values change, and we realize that all that the world can give is but too little. Its power and knowledge are the gifts of time and cannot fill the spirit's sacred thirst. Our world is time-bound. We are framed in space and time, and all the power, all the knowledge that the world can give us are products of time, products of the movement of time. and they truly cannot satiate, satisfy the sacred thirst of the spirit. Mark the word sacred thirst, the normal seeking, desiring is of the senses. But here, the spirit's sacred thirst, Mother was very fond of using this word thirst, that intense aspiration that cannot be satisfied, that cannot be fulfilled by the gifts of time, that can be met only by the gifts of what is beyond time, of what is eternal. The spirit is eternal, and its hunger can be satisfied only by the giving from the eternal. Although of one these forms of greatness are, all these things, the power, the knowledge, they are forms of that one. There is one reality, and the best that we can get are forms of its greatness. And by its breath of grace our lives abide. We are able to live, we are able to eke out our existence only because of the breath of grace. Grace is that special movement of the divine consciousness which enables us to live, to move. Although more near to us than nearness self, in a sense that one which is beyond time, which is beyond the grasp of our mind, is close to us, closer than closeness itself. The self of nearness, the core of nearness, this one is nearer than that. It is some utter truth of what we are. Why is it so near to us? Because truly, it is the irreducible truth, the ultimate and the final truth of what we are. After reducing everything that changes and moves, something immutable, something static, stationary, stable, that is that one. After making these general observations, giving, so to say, the background of Ashwapati, now he links up to the stage where Ashwapati has arrived, says, hidden by its own works, it seemed far off. That one reality, that mysterious truth, is veiled by its own works, by its own movements. Swagunair nigudam devatma shaktim, says the Upanishad. that self-power of God, hidden by its own form, workings. So here he says, hidden by its own works, it seemed far off to Ashwapati, impenetrable. His mental gaze cannot penetrate into it, occult, not visible, voiceless, not articulate, obscure, vague, can't spot it out. The presence was lost by which all things have charm. All things in life derive their charm from some presence, from something in them. The beauty, the charm, is not really due to our external decorations or embellishments, but there is some, what is it called in Sanskrit, kala, life kala. Without that, even a very beautiful form doesn't attract. But there is some presence of a consciousness which make things have charm. The presence was lost by which all things have charm. The glory lacked, of which they are dim signs. All things are dim, obscure signs of some glory, glory of God. But that glory is missing. Where is that glory? Ashwapati is wondering. The world lived on, made empty of its cause. The cause, the original cause, is not there to his experience. So, but the world lives on, but he feels it empty. Without the cause that makes it living, he feels the world is empty. It manages to live on, though. Like love, when the beloved's face is gone. Love continues in some form as the world continues. But the object of that love, the focus of that love, the base of that love, the face of the beloved, it is gone. So love becomes dry. That's how the world, made empty of its cause, lived on. The labor to know seemed a vain strife of mind. All his labor to know the ultimate seemed a useless struggle of the mind, because all knowledge ended in the unknowable. All knowledge, lower and higher, ultimately ended in something where you have to say, I do not know. There is something, but which can't be known. The effort to rule seemed a vain pride of will. Effort to rule nature, movements of nature, to rule the world, is now realized to be a proud effort of will which has gone in vain. Willpower, a futile exercise of willpower. A trivial achievement, scorned by time, all power retired into the omnipotent. all the power that had been built up, that had been wielded, cherished as a power, achievement, turns out to be something trivial, which is scorned by time. For the immensity of time, this little power is a very insignificant affair. It retired into the omnipotent, before the omnipotence of God, before the omnipotent mystery. What's this human power? So it is as if it is retired there. And then he makes one epigram, his observation, the observation of the poet: a cave of darkness guards the eternal light. There is an eternal light in every one of us, everywhere, but it is as it were guarded, protected from profane, vulgar sight by a cave of darkness. Cave, it signifies a narrowing, darkening enclosure. That is a blanket of darkness guards the eternal light. So where there is such darkness, thick, massive darkness, you can be sure that deep inside there is the light eternal. So when he feels that he can't know anything, everything that has been achieved falls into insignificance. There is a hint to the poet, that very obscurity, that very sense of vanity of things is a veil which covers some great truth, some inextinguishable light. Now he relates, again we come to Ashwapati's condition, a silence settled on his striving heart. So far his heart was aspiring, was agitated. Why I have not seen that ultimate mystery? Why I am still on the border? And he says, a silence. It comes from elsewhere. That is why he says, settled. A silence settled on his striving heart. So the heart falls silent, absolved from the voices of the world's desire, freed, delivered from the voices of the world's desire. World's desire, not his own desire. He has long ago surpassed the reach of his own desire. Desire is no more valid for him. But as a king, as a representative of humanity, he does take cognizance of the world's desire, the need of the world, the claims of the world, the aspirations of the world. All of them call him, entreat him. But now, at this stage, absolved from the voices of the world's desire, he turned to the ineffable, timeless cause. he hears a call. He leaves everything aside. The call of the timeless, eternal, ineffable. Ineffable is what cannot be described, what cannot be spelt out, what cannot be communicated. You may experience it, but you can't express it. So he turned to the ineffable's timeless call. And what's that ineffable that is calling? A being intimate and unnameable, a vast being, which he however feels very intimate, very close to him, and yet unnameable. It can't bear any name. It can't be defined. A wide, compelling ecstasy and peace. That being itself is exuding a wide ecstasy, a wide peace. But they are not just states of peace and ecstasy, but they are compelling. There is power in that ecstasy, force in that peace, which compel, which impose themselves. A being intimate and unnameable, a wide, compelling ecstasy and peace, felt in himself and all, and yet ungrasped. He feels that peace, he feels that ecstasy in himself and all around, and yet he cannot hold it, he cannot grasp it. Approached that being, approached and faded from his soul's pursuit. He feels as if it is coming nearer. And then when his soul's, his inner being tries to touch, reach it, it fades away. As if forever luring him beyond. As if it is a strategy to lure him, to attract him, to pull him out beyond the formed existence. Near, it retreated. When he feels it near, it just retreats. Far, it called him still. It doesn't remain far, it calls him. Nothing could satisfy but its delight. It had that delight with it, that being. Once having tasted it, nothing else could satisfy him. Its absence left the greatest actions dull. When that delight of that being was not there, the greatest actions that he might do, they were felt as dull. Its presence made the smallest seem divine. The presence of that being, the presence of that vibration of delight, made even the smallest movement, smallest action, a divine movement and a divine action. So when it is there, everything seems divine. When it is absent, whatever the action, however great, one feels things dull. When it was there, the heart's abyss was filled. The profounds, the depths of the heart they were filled when that being is there. But when the uplifting deity withdrew, when that elevating deity, the divine being withdrew, existence lost its aim in the inane. Inane, it is a vast, nebulous something which has no character. So existence lost its aim. Where it is, existence does not know where it is going, why it is living, and it loses itself in the nebulous vastness. It is only the presence of that deity that gives meaning, that gives direction, that gives the joy of life. I think we are stopped better there and meditate as usual.